Barrett Brown. Thanks for listening to our Who, What, Why podcast. Our guest today is Philip Kingston, a city council person out of Dallas, Texas, one of the leaders in a sort of makeshift opposition against Dallas's history of oligarchical rule, as it's often depicted. A few months ago, there was an election in Dallas, and Kingston, who had been a vocal critic of the mayor, who himself is very much a defender of a sort of go-along-to-get-along establishment in the city of Dallas that's existed for decades and decades. And Mr. Kingston and a few others who have served formed a sort of almost technocratic coalition on the council, not only won re-election in a contest in which the mayor's associates, former political aides, ran unprecedented ads against Kingston. Not only won, but also saw many of their opposition on the council defeated. It was an extraordinary upset in the city of Dallas. And afterwards, the Dallas Morning News, which had been a backer of the mayor and of a certain way of Dallas governance, wrote an editorial castigating the people of Kingston's district for reelecting him. Philip, about a year ago, after the presidential election, with Trump suddenly taking power over the world's most complex society, there was a lot of talk about cities taking some of the burden of governance, about a shift towards city civics, with people having somewhat given up, perhaps, on national civics. How much room do you think there is for cities like Dallas or Houston or New York or Los Angeles to take on a more central role in how people see their civics and how people conduct their civics?
There's a lot of room there. There are some hard limits. And the Trump election, Barrett, I would agree, accelerated people's desire to find out what the limits are. But the idea that cities were the last place for innovation is not that new. When the French were planning for the last international climate summit, the IPCC, they actually reached out to cities because they anticipated that there would be no state level, meaning national level, agreement that would mean anything in particular. And so they reached out to cities to see what we could do on a local level to try to forestall climate change. Now that's sort of an extreme example. It's saying that that's a real surrender on the part of people in national level governments to say this problem that's, you know, completely getting more and more obvious by the day, that is very clearly an international problem that ought to be solved by international cooperation. Its most effective opponents, the most effective means of combating it are at the local level. We live in a very topsy-turvy world, and it's that way not just in the United States but across the globe.
With that having occurred recently, and that being, as you said, a sort of unprecedented or at least very unusual deferment or de facto deferment by the nation to the cities, and with also some of the challenges that have come to the Trump administration from states, which not entirely unprecedented, but a bit more, I think, rigorous than we've seen in prior administrations, certainly. This is certainly an acceleration to that, to a decentralized civic mentality, isn't it?
That's 100% right. But, you know, the problem is that the roles of the state government in our federal system and the federal government have been fought over for 200 years. And there are some really hard definitions in there. So, for instance, when we at the city level talk about wanting to reform the way we do land use to make it more equitable, because we can see that the way that we do zoning actually is promoting some of the social ills we see, like segregation. So we at the city, being good urbanists, think, well, if we cut down on parking, then we're going to get more dense land use and it'll encourage people to locate jobs closer to housing and a bunch of other good things that you get out of that. And the reason we don't do that is because years ago, the state, not in an analogous situation to what Trump administration is now doing to the states themselves, the state took away cities' ability to regulate the sale of alcohol. We can do nothing to stop the proliferation of bars in neighborhoods except require them to have a lot of parking. So we find ourselves shackled in some ways by the higher levels of government, where they've already taken tools away from us that we could otherwise use to fix our own problems without, by the way, asking them for more money. So we do not live in a well-designed regulatory environment. We live in an ad hoc regulatory environment, and we're just trying to do the best we can.
Yeah, that seems to me exactly one of the fundamental problems of our governance in general. Going back to Dallas, or going back to that victory in Dallas, which was very unprecedented, and I got the chance to kind of watch that drama unfold since I was covering city council in the months running up to that election. Do you think that kind of victory, which I suppose in this case was sort of fueled by a different demographic in the cities, you know, a more obviously technocratic or pragmatic, younger
grassroots
ownership. Yeah. Do you think that kind of victory that we've seen in Dallas, is that something we've seen elsewhere in the country that you're unaware of? And is it something we can expect to see a more adult governance on the civic level in major cities?
Yes, I believe it's a trend. You know, we love to think of ourselves as special, and we never are. I see that, basically, in the wake of the Trump election, a lot of people who previously were not engaged in politics or civic life have awakened. And we see in San Antonio, they got a new, very progressive mayor replacing one who was decidedly not. We see the city council in Houston being run totally by progressives, even though as a city, it is a much more conservative electorate than we have here in Dallas. Austin, of course, has become the target of the state legislature because of its progressive policies. So I think it's very much a trend, and it's a trend I'm trying to help organize. I, along with three other city councilmen from other cities, have formed a group called Texas Urban Policymakers, where we're trying to get together around shared goals and maybe do some statewide advocacy on things that we all care about, related to urbanism more than just progressive policy. So transportation, for instance, has become a means in which to separate people, and these massive car-oriented infrastructure projects simply serve to promote segregation, promote poor air quality. There's a lot of stuff to unpack there, but those things, when we can organize around that stuff, then what we find is we suddenly have an effective tool with a state government that doesn't respect our point of view and would like to run roughshod over us. And so we'll be meeting next month with Victor Vandergriff, who's a TxDOT commissioner, to work on a platform for advocating for urban transportation projects, which almost all are non-automotive.
Now, we have in Dallas fine examples, very interesting examples of the city taking a leadership role that, again, not unprecedented, but perhaps a little bit more amplified than previous years. For one thing, we had, at the onset of the travel ban, we did have leadership from this mayor, Mayor Rawlings, who, as you and I both know, if our listeners may not, is not Jack Kennedy. but who was very vocal in helping to show support to our city's immigrants, both in that and in the travel ban, and also with some of the immigration, broader immigration things. And now, more recently, we have another situation in which Dallas has, among other cities, taken the lead in getting rid of, in this case, the Robert E. Lee statue that's been in a park near where I live, actually, for quite a while. It's what the first thing I wrote about when I started writing for The Guardian. In the process of getting that statue removed, has there been much opposition from anyone worth worrying about?
Not overt. That's an interesting question, because the way that got started, Barrett, is this group of clergy and historians and artists all came to visit me to see if I could help them with monument removal. And I had been thinking about it before that, because the New Orleans situation, the Landrieu speech, I consider to be one of the best pieces of American oratory in the last 10 years. And it really convinced me. And so I was thinking about how to do this in Dallas, and one of the things I knew I needed was a group of advocates with real credibility, and they just showed up on my doorstep. So it was a very easy thing to say, yes, I'll help you. But of course, they hadn't started with me. They started with the mayor, who would not help them. Jim Schutz actually has a great recitation of what happened. We filed our memo, which forces the issue onto the agenda, in early August. And the mayor's first reaction was, well, for one thing, he's never acknowledged that it even existed. And his first reaction was to appoint a task force, not to answer the question of when or how to take down the monuments, but to answer the question of whether to take down the monuments. What that tells me is that he had and his words about the monuments were that they were racist propaganda, and he was saying good things in that regard, but what it raises in my mind is the possibility that he had a contributor problem, that he has important supporters who are not thrilled to see these things come down. And I don't know who that is. I don't want to slander somebody by speculating. That seems obvious to me. So our strategy was an inside-outside strategy. I was working the council. I was surprised that I didn't get more support initially from the African-American council members, but they came around. And part of that is because of the outside strategy, which was to get every important clergy member in town and every important historian and their neighbors, the people who vote for them, to call them. And that pressure is what changed everybody from early August to early September. We went from, basically just a few of us on council talking about this and demanding immediate action, to a near unanimous vote this week to take down the Lee statue immediately. And the only reason it's still up is we're having trouble with the rather robust construction of the thing.
That brings me to another question. Is the old setup, whereby contributors have an outsized degree of influence over these races, whether it be mayoral or city council, and an outsized influence over what makes the agenda and how things run, is that something that could be diminished, or is it something that has been diminished relative to other more grassroots forces? And if so, does that have anything to do with the information age or demographic change, or what would that be?
It is undeniable that better communication diminishes the influence of money in public thought. So I don't know to what extent. We always joke in politics that you have to be on social media because it gives you an air of credibility, but the only people who are looking at it are basically reporters. So you're not actually getting any votes, but you may be getting your message out. So I would say technology definitely has something to do with it, but until and unless the U.S. completely revamps campaign finance and just levels the playing field with, a single pool of money that everybody's allowed to use, then money will always have an outsized influence. And really, even with a system like that, you know, money has a way of working its way into power. It just, that's just the way it works. But we're going to, next week, we will be trying to diminish its power somewhat, in that we are going to try to limit the total spending that any political action committee can do in a local race. So when you were, when, in your very kind introduction earlier, when you're talking about all of the money that was spent to try to kick me out of office, most of it was spent through the use of a loophole in Texas campaign finance law that says basically that political action committees can spend unlimited dollars for or against a candidate so long as they do not coordinate with that candidate's campaign. And we can set a limit on that at the local level. And that's what I will try to do next Wednesday. And it's an interesting thing. One of my colleagues immediately had a negative reaction to it and said, I think that's unconstitutional. And then he thought about it a little while and he realized that not only would it eliminate the PAC support that he got, but it would severely restrict the three PACs that worked against him. So I think he may be coming around on it.
That's good. Well, it reminds me of the mayor who, during the ethics debate a few months ago, and this is something that's the ethics debate in Dallas, vis-a-vis the cities, was replicated and is very much very similar to the same debates that are going on in cities across the country. In fact, you know, we obviously explored what other cities have done to some extent, you know, before putting these forward. But the mayor, you know, had opposed one kind of restriction on people who have been close to a campaign working in politics on the grounds that it's against free speech. And the other one he supported on the grounds that it's practical and helpful, and then sort of confronted himself with the dilemma in real time. And he was sitting there saying, well, maybe there's a contradiction there, but you know, whatever, you know, it was an extraordinary performance. Anyway, but my last question for you is, so we've seen several instances since Trump's election of really robust confrontations between the Trump administration and cities, with the travel ban, for instance, and now I think increasing with immigration. Regardless of what happens with the DACA, given that we could still see other very dramatic immigration crackdowns, it looks like, in fact, that the INS is openly plotting a pretty unprecedented large-scale crackdown on immigration right now. Is it possible that we'll see almost a civil disobedience level reaction from some cities in this nation on immigration and other issues?
I drafted a resolution just last week that calls for the city of Dallas to pay lawyers to represent dreamers for the purpose of trying to keep them in the country.
It might be an uphill battle, you think, or in the council?
I don't know. The council is pretty pro-immigration. Now, when there's talk, and then there's backing up talk with a budget. So that's where the rubber's going to meet the road on that deal. But yeah, I love civil disobedience. I hate I'm just a regular old politician. I do not like another politician taking power away from me. And, you know, if there's going to be an opportunity, for instance, with the cite and release package that we passed on low-level marijuana possession, where we're not going to arrest people anymore for marijuana, all that stuff is forms of local civil disobedience on the municipal government level. And I firmly think that if we see really draconian anti-immigrant moves by the federal government, you'll see that work its way down to the grassroots level. And I think you'll see people take active steps to hide immigrants or to protect them in some way. Frankly, I've got two bedrooms in my house I'm not using.
Bill Kingston, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate your insights into our national breakdown.
Thanks, Barrett. You're one of the best chroniclers of it.
I've been very close to it. Thanks again. Thank you for listening to our Who What Why podcast.